It takes less water and fewer carbon emissions to make a beefless burger. But to make its veggie burger more appealing to meat eaters, one company is adding an ingredient that makes their patty bleed.
It's the same molecule that carries oxygen in your blood and makes it red, but it's actually found in every living thing.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, a bid to fight climate change through our taste buds. Plus,
the Ohio River actually receives more pollution from industrial sites than any other river in the country.
So why is the commission that sets pollution standards for the river looking to give up that authority? And a new book asks urban Americans to consider the rural people and places that help power the country.
We need to know what happens when we turn on our lights. We need to know who's paying those costs.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. 2.5 years after announcing a major climate initiative, the Wolf administration has only followed through on part of its plan. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick explains.
In early 2016, Governor Tom Wolf announced a two-pronged approach to cut methane emissions from Pennsylvania's oil and gas industry. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas that's dozens of times more powerful than carbon dioxide. Part of the strategy was to create revised general permits for new oil and gas sites. The State Department of Environmental Protection just finalized those requirements, but they don't affect the thousands of existing oil and gas wells in the state. The second part of the strategy is to create a set of regulations for those existing sites. Although the administration originally planned to propose those new rules a year ago, they now say there is no specific timeline for them and did not respond to questions about the delay from State Impact. State data show overall methane emissions from the shale gas industry rising, while other air pollutants are falling. The increase is mostly due to the growth in the number of sites filing reports, while the average emissions per site is staying relatively level. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
A new book looks at another impact of the oil and gas industry in Pennsylvania. Poet and reporter Eliza Griswold's nonfiction work, Amity and Prosperity, takes readers to rural Washington County, where Stacy Haney, a nurse and single mother, is living less than half a mile from fracking waste and drill cutting pits on a neighbor's property.
Stacy and her family contract mysterious illnesses, and they end up leaving their farm that had belonged to her great-grandfather, and she has to handle two mortgages as well as mounting doctor's bills as she tries to get her head around what's happening to her family.
Haney's son is diagnosed with arsenic poisoning. Animals on their farm get sick and die. The same animals Haney hoped to build a new barn for with the money from her own gas lease. Griswold spent over 7 years talking to neighbors in the community of Amity, gas executives, and the Department of Environmental Protection, among others, as Haney and eventually her lawyers try to get the drilling company to take responsibility for the air and water pollution near her home.
A theme that keeps cropping up in the book is this notion of the rights of the individual and the rights of the whole, or the commonwealth.
This whole idea of Pennsylvania as a commonwealth, like what are our commonly held assets? Well, our water and our air, and how Pennsylvanians have such a long history of wrestling with this issue, longer, I'd argue, than any other Americans. And that really dates back to the timber industry and a group of citizens rising up to say, you know, look at what timber has cost us. And they weren't saying, you know, let's keep all of these resources pristine. They said, no, we need to figure out prudent use for future generations. And so that long history of conservationism has led people to a heightened, plus that comes directly out of people's long experience with extractive industry. That double awareness has given people very sophisticated understandings of what the commons are because they see them being affected all the day. If you've watched, you know, a coal company go bankrupt and abandon your town, and you've watched the slag heaps left behind that nobody can afford to remove, and you've seen both the social and economic impacts all at once, then you have a pretty good understanding of, hey, these costs are being left to us. directly out of that experience, Pennsylvanians were able to come up with this remarkable environmental amendment, which is the right to clean air and pure water. And this environmental amendment has actually, over the past few years, gotten teeth for the very first time due to the work of some of the lawyers who've represented Stacey. John and Kendra Smith, along with others, have really done remarkable work in safeguarding the commons by protecting these individual rights at the same time.
The Smiths were instrumental in challenging the state's oil and gas law, Act 13. A Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling said the law violated people's right to protect their property. And you sort of relate in the book that Stacey Haney takes some solace, some pride in her testimony leading to that decision.
For Stacey, when the conservative Chief Justice, Ron Castile, finds in favor of protecting small towns, and he quotes her affidavit of her experience, she absolutely felt and continues to feel that her role in that case, after having her children, was the most important thing she's done as a human being.
As much as your book is her story, the story of a single mother speaking out for her home and her family's health, it's an indictment of Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection. What are some of the details that you uncovered about how the department regulated and dealt with the oil and gas industry and people like Stacey Haney?
The harshest indictment I've seen of the DEP's failures comes from its own Inspector General report. To be fair, the DEP is woefully underfunded and understaffed.
The DEP was seen as very chummy with the oil and gas industry, and Stacey Haney and her neighbors felt that they were keeping information back from them.
Yeah. You know, one of them actually witnessed a DEP employee asking an oil and gas employee if there were any jobs available while they were on the site to regulate. That is one of the sad realities of public poverty, right? When the DEP inspectors are underfunded and they're not paid very much, how are they supposed to? We're supposed to ask them to stay in those jobs because it's noble? As much as it's an individual problem within the DEP, it's also what happens when we don't maintain the systems designed to protect all of us.
One of Stacey Haney's lawyers compared what's happened to the water in Amity from fracking to the lead crisis in Flint, Michigan. Only in this case, in Pennsylvania, the federal government hasn't stepped in. What's the difference?
That the people in Amity are on private water, not public, and there are only three of them as opposed to hundreds. And that's the difference right there. Private water changes the law immediately. And, you know, it's easy for an outsider to come in and say, oh, you know, people's wells should be protected. They should be regulated. But this is where you get into the complex reality of life for rural people. A lot of people don't want those regulations. They're going to be expensive to meet. They're going to be arbitrary. This kind of complexity in this small instance really reveals some of the larger tensions facing America today and how we're going to resolve them between those who want more regulation, those who don't, those who have been, you know, really screwed over by regulation. I mean, in this area, as you well know, a lot of the people who support fracking are also farmers, and they are regulated to crazy levels. You know, every time a pig needs a shot, they have to have a vet come out, and that's going to cost $100. They can't drive a tractor into a stream because there are regulations. At the same time, you know, the oil and gas industry can come out and wreak havoc. And there are no regulations. There are plenty of regulations to stop them, but there are cases in which regulations fail, and this is one of those cases.
You write very lyrically about the history of this region, the frontier days and the whiskey rebellion, the coal jobs and the bust. What will this period, or how should this period in its history be remembered?
Well, first of all, thank you for saying so. I mean, that to me is, it's so important. Not the writing per se, but the larger context of this story. Because as much as it's about, you know, a legal thriller, like the foreground narrative, like why you turn the page is what happened to Stacey and the kids. But the background narrative, what the book is really about, is what it has meant to a collection of rural Americans to pay for the energy appetites of urban Americans and how that experience has deepened the divide between rural and urban and how the rest of us really need to pay more attention to what's happening. Like, we need to know what happens when we turn on our lights. We need to know who's paying those costs. And we don't want to know. You know, coming back to New York, where I do live, nobody wants to talk about fracking. Why? Because we're implicated, and we don't want to own our implication in these larger cycles of fossil fuel extraction, which, and I just want to be very clear, there are people within this book who have had a very positive experience with both the company and the extractive process themselves, and they also deserve to be heard and spoken to. So it's complicated. You know, how will we look back at this era? We will certainly look at the rise of citizen heroes like Stacy and her neighbors, people who stood up for what was right. There is a hopeful story here. Against the rest of it, I think it's too early to know. My fear is that once again, the region will be left with these externalized costs, right? That we will see a pattern of boom and bust, that people will be left paying the cost of this industry that was supposed to be their payday, their way out.
Eliza Griswold, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Eliza Griswold is the author of Amity and Prosperity, One Family and the Fracturing of America. And she's speaking in Washington County on June 20th and at the Pittsburgh Arts and Lecture Series on June 21st. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. It's finally summer, and that means grilling season is in full swing. But what are you throwing on that charcoal? Few things have as big an impact on our environment as the food we eat. Agriculture accounts for one-third of global greenhouse gas emissions, and beef production in particular uses a lot of water when compared with other foods. So some scientists have been working in the lab to create a vegan burger that bleeds like beef without these downsides. It's called the Impossible Burger, and it's being served at select restaurants around the country. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant and I visited one in Pittsburgh.
This is one of the best work days. I'm meeting colleagues at Burgatory, a high-end burger place in Pittsburgh, to try the Impossible Burger.
Hi, I'm Kara Holsapple. I'm the host of the Allegheny Front.
Kara eats vegan. She makes homemade veggie burgers. But the Impossible Burger is supposed to really taste like meat.
And I'm excited. How are you feeling about this?
Yeah, I'm excited to have it.
That's Hal B. Klein. He's a restaurant critic and editor at Pittsburgh Magazine. He wrote an article called Burgers, Burgers, Burgers.
And I probably ate around 45 burgers researching the story.
Hello. My name is Jules. I'll be taking care of you guys.
Yeah. The Impossible Burger for me?
Burger for me.
Yeah, I want the Impossible Burger, but I want the vegan cheese and mayo.
And the mayo?
Yeah.
All right.
I followed Chef Brad Koha to the kitchen.
Careful, might be a little slick.
He pulls out a stack of regular-looking patties and peels one off. Meat burgers go on the open-fire grill. Impossible burgers sizzle on the flat top.
Just like a regular burger. You put it on, the patty looked kind of dry, but as we're cooking it now, you can see that heme, that blood, the fat coming out.
That heme Chef Koha mentioned, the blood-like juice that seeps out as it cooks, it's the key reason why this vegan burger debuted not in the freezer aisle, but at New York's well-known Momofuku Nishi restaurant. It's also why the company behind it, Silicon Valley's Impossible Foods, has garnered a reported $300 million in investments from the likes of Bill Gates and Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz. So what is heme? The company did not respond to an interview request.
Introducing Impossible Burger.
This is a video from their website.
Invented by a pretty cool scientist named Pat Brown.
Brown left his position as a biochemistry professor at Stanford University to develop this plant-based burger with all the properties of meat. On the video, they mix up wheat and potato flour to give it texture. They crack a coconut. Its oil provides the fat. And there's a small bowl of a blood-like liquid.
What's this red stuff?
That is heme. It's the same molecule that carries oxygen in your blood and makes it red. But it's actually found in every living thing, even plants.
Impossible Foods uses genetic engineering to take a protein gene called leg hemoglobin from the root of a soy plant and add it to a yeast strain. They grow the yeast through fermentation, then isolate the heme and add it to their burgers.
Well, that turns out to be, one, their big claim to fame, and two, their big Achilles heel.
Carl Batt is a professor at Cornell's Department of Food Science. He says the Food and Drug Administration did not approve soy-like hemoglobin for consumption.
It turns out the FDA doesn't consider that to be generally recognized as safe.
But Impossible Foods doesn't actually need FDA approval and started selling the burger anyway. The company has said their burger is lab-tested and safe to eat. And it's scaling up to produce 1 million pounds per month. Their video spells out why eating one Impossible burger is better than a beef patty.
You save water equivalent to a 10-minute shower.
You spare 18 driving miles worth of greenhouse gases. And you spare 75 square feet of land for wildlife and more.
But the question for high-tech food companies and for us at lunch at Burgatory, would people actually choose this vegetarian protein over cow meat?
All right. I have your Impossible burgers here.
All right. I mean, it's interesting, right? So it's like a little bit mushier than a beef burger. And there's like a sort of grain flavor.
I don't see any blood. I mean, it is a little pink in the middle, but it's not like bloody. I thought I might be a little grossed out, but I'm not.
And we put the question to Chef Kohut.
Think the Impossible burger would fool anyone?
Well, definitely fool people, but there's a lot of foolish people out there.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
That story won a Golden Quill Award for Best Radio Feature from the Press Club of Western Pennsylvania. And we have a few more feathers in our cap. You can hear those winning stories at AlleghenyFront.org. More than 5 million people rely on the Ohio River for drinking water, but it's a working river, lined with coal-fired power plants and other industries. ORSENCO is a multi-state commission representing 8 states, including Pennsylvania, and it's responsible for setting pollution standards along the Ohio, like how much sewage and industrial waste can be dumped into the river. But at a recent meeting, a preliminary vote by ORSENCO members indicates the commission might be stepping out of that regulatory role. James Bruggers is a reporter covering this issue for Inside Climate News. That's a not-for-profit, nonpartisan news organization covering energy and the environment. Before that, he worked at Louisville's Courier-Journal, where he covered these topics for more than 18 years. James, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you.
First, what's ORSENCO's role and where does it get its power and authority?
Well, ORSENCO was formed back in the 1940s when 8 states got together and signed a compact. So the authority comes from the compact, an agreement with these states. At the time, the Ohio River was really little more than an open sewer with, you know, essentially untreated sewage going in, plus all kinds of industrial pollution as well. And so this was well before the EPA was formed and the Clean Water Act was passed in the, you know, the early 1970s. And it's been credited with really helping to bring about water quality improvements to the Ohio River.
So as regards this preliminary vote, why would ORSENCO cede its power to set pollution standards?
The argument that has been used by the industries that have supported this is that there's a redundancy, that there's too many levels of bureaucracy, and they think that it would be simpler, easier, and more effective if they simply relied on the states using guidance from the US EPA. ORSENCO doesn't actually enforce themselves. They rely on states to do the enforcement. They don't have, you know, a water pollution police force, for example. But ORSENCO actually has authority to pass standards that are more stringent than the US EPA, and it has done that in some cases.
Could you give an example of that?
I can tell you that a study found by ORSENCO found that there were 188 incidences in which ORSENCO had set standards for a pollutant that neither a member state nor the EPA had set a standard for, and there were some 252 incidents where ORSENCO standards were at least 10% more stringent than those of the member states or the EPA. One of them was arsenic, which can be found in waste from the burning of coal and is also known to cause cancer. But one of the arguments in this particular case that environmental groups made was that the value of having an independent commission like ORSENCO to be able to act on pollution issues when the federal government does not, it gives regional voice and power to, you know, the regulatory process. So regional flexibility. So that, you know, that regional flexibility, that regional authority would go away And we would be reliant on the EPA. Now, on the other hand, the Clean Water Act does not go away. So, you know, ultimately, whatever's done would have to comply with the Clean Water Act. But then, you know, the EPA, you know, would have a big say in kind of what that means.
So if Orsenco were to give up this power to set pollution standards, how would it use its resources? What would its role be then?
Orsenco does research and they do monitoring. Those issues are pretty important, and the states do rely on them. I recall a couple of years ago, there was a big spill in West Virginia, and that sent a slug of a big plume of pollution down the river, and it affected drinking water treatment as it moved along the river, at least as far down as Louisville, where I'm at, which is quite a ways. And so Orsenco, anytime there's a spill, they're out there on the river trying to map the plume. They work with their partners in the states and in some cases drinking water utilities. And they're out there trying to identify the concentration of the plume, the extent of the plume, how fast it's moving, so that when it comes to a drinking water utility intake, then that drinking water utility can know, you know, how to treat it. And so that's a very big function of them. And they do have a monitoring network that is designed to detect different types of pollutants in the river. So that is a way to help identify when there are spills, because sometimes they're not always reported right away. And they also do some research. In fact, a couple of years ago, one of the studies they did found that the, it wasn't a very heavy-duty study, but they took pollution discharge information from 600 different industrial plants that are located along the river, and they were able to conclude that the Ohio River actually receives more pollution from industrial sites than any other river in the country.
This is a preliminary vote. The final vote may come as soon as this fall?
That's the plan, and between now and the fall, I'm told that the Orsenco staff promises to do some webinars so the public can learn more about what the proposal is. And there'll be a public comment period, and there'll be at least one public hearing. One other thing I might like to add is, you know, politics can change and pendulums can swing back and forth. And one of the things that the regional authority, hypothetically or ideally, it served as a potentially moderating force for the kind of political swings that might happen from year to year and from state to state. It is interesting, during the meeting that was held here last week, some critics of the proposal had articulated a concern that this could actually end up pitting states against states. So that'll be an interesting thing to watch as well if this goes through, is say you have a state that's really concerned about a particular pollutant that's downstream from another state that's not so concerned about that pollutant. But, you know, the river knows no political boundaries, and so this would perhaps, if they go through with this, would eliminate that flexibility that the commission could have to have a forum, a regional forum, to discuss and take action on, you know, those problems. They'll still get together and meet, and they can talk about things, but, you know, it does eliminate that ability to be able to maybe rise above the political vagaries of the moment.
Thank you so much for talking with me. Really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
James Bruggers covers the Southeast for Inside Climate News, and he joined me from Louisville. There's more about Orsenco and the Ohio River. We did a whole series about it called Headwaters. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel. So there are some issues facing the Ohio River, but it got us thinking about a story from a few years ago, a more buoyant story about an aspect of life on the river, boating culture. We talked to a Pittsburgher with a pretty close perspective on it, since he was living year-round at a marina on the Ohio.
My name's Jason Fleming. I live on the North Shore of Pittsburgh, PA, and I'm the resident manager of Newport Marina. You know, on paper, it doesn't sound like a great deal. I live in a 40-foot trailer with extended pop-outs. You know, the running joke amongst all my friends, and I've had to own it because you can't avoid it, is I live in a van down by the river. The fact that I have a 20-foot by 20-foot deck that's right on the water, and what I guess I would describe as kind of a carefree bohemian lifestyle, that makes it all worth it. Somebody asked me the other day what was the weirdest thing I saw on the river, and I had to think about it, and then I came up with it. It was the 4th of July a couple years ago, and at some point, some knucklehead got a little tiny like rowboat with an outboard motor, and it was just him and his very pregnant girlfriend on the boat. At one point, I heard some commotion and looked out. The boyfriend had fallen or jumped out of the boat, I don't know why, leaving his pregnant and now panicking girlfriend in the boat with the outboard motor stuck, apparently, at full throttle and in a full turning position. So now the rowboat is doing very loud, very aggressive concentric circles in the river. And people were slowly thinking, well, how's this going to end? And can we do anything? But nobody was really going out of their way to come up with a plan. Until those concentric circles that the boat was going in started getting closer and closer to some very expensive cabin cruisers. And suddenly that passive curiosity turned into like SEAL Team 6 brainstorming. And everybody suddenly had a plan because they didn't want their boats touched. And what ultimately happened was a brave young soul got on the back of a jet ski, not a Wave Runner, not a Sea-Doo, one of those old school jet skis, took it out to her, and in what was admittedly a very impressive feat, jumped from the jet ski onto this boat that's turning in circles, TJ Hooker style, got in the boat, and immediately turned off the engine and saved the day. Mind you, he was not the person who saved the day, the boyfriend. I don't know if that relationship stood the test of time, as he jumped out and left her on the boat. Boating is a subculture, like any other subculture. It's like kind of a weird fraternity. People talk about the expense of the boat, how the two happiest days in a boat owner's life is the day they buy the boat and the day they sell the boat. For those people who don't use their boat frequently, no amount of money is worth it. If you use your boat all the time, and you really just suck the recreational marrow out of that boat, then it doesn't matter what you pay for the boat. It's worth it 100%. And the people who use it all the time tend to create their own little community here on the river. On any given football Sunday or Kenny Chesney concert or 4th of July fireworks, you'll find people from 5, 6, 7 different marinas all down by the point. They've, you know, tied their boats off together in a giant flotilla, party flotilla, and they just love it. I don't know, it's the perfect way to not be at work and not be at home for them. The escape is the river. Surprisingly, for someone who lives on the river, I don't own a boat. But 5 times a week minimum, every week of the year, somebody comes by, "Do you live here?" "Yes." "Oh my God, that is the coolest thing in the world. I wish I could live here." And they all typically are people with wives and kids and responsibilities, and they see this as what I see it as, actually, is a wonderful escape in the middle of the city.
That was Jason Fleming from a few years back. Producer Lou Bluin talked with him at the Newport Marina on the Ohio River. His story is one of many documenting the people that shape life on the Three Rivers. For more, motor over to AlleghenyFront.org/Our Three Rivers. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and our podcast, Trump on Earth. All of those episodes are at TrumpOnEarth.org. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Katherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.